In the interim, until that happens, there is a prophecy of the Prophet alayhi salatu wasalam concerning what's going to happen to us in the interim. He said, my ummah will be divided like they were divided, the Jews and Christians. There were 72, and we will be how many? 73. Only one will go to heaven. All the rest will go to hell. Without a shadow of a doubt, the one jama'ah which will go to heaven must, in addition to other credentials, must be a group of Muslims organized as a jama'ah with an amir, with a pledge to obey, and struggling for the restoration of the caliphate. It must also, of course, be struggling to join forces with all others who are pursuing the same goal. Now let us return to Sharif al-Hussein and the Meccan Caliphate of March to June 1924. What is the strategic environment in which this caliphate is born? The strategic environment is, number one, the British Zionist Alliance, consolidated in 1916 or 17, the Balfour Declaration, in which the British government made an open declaration supporting the establishment of a Jewish national homeland in Palestine. What is the strategic environment in which this caliphate is born? Another alliance. Let me introduce it to it. Not 1917, 1916. It's hidden. Someone has to bring it out. Another alliance. That was between Britain and the Jews. This is between Britain and a man named Abdulaziz ibn Saud. His son was here recently. But surely, surely, at least in this city, a servant of Islam should have the freedom to reveal the truth. The alliance between Britain and Abdulaziz ibn Saud, who had taken control of Riyadh, who was the ruler of Riyadh, was concluded in 1916. And in that treaty, Abdulaziz became an ally of Britain and pledged a benevolent neutrality in Britain's political designs in the Arabian Peninsula. A benevolent neutrality. What was the price that Britain had to pay to Abdulaziz? Sharif al-Hussein was a better businessman. The grandfather, or the great-grandfather of King Hussein. You know the sum of money I'm talking about, if you read my book. He was able to secure a deal for 7 million sterling pounds for betraying the Muslims. That's Sharif al-Hussein. Ibn Saud didn't have that clout, so Ibn Saud was able to negotiate and secure only 5,000 sterling pounds a month. You can be sure that that information is buried, very difficult to unearth it. But that information did reach his ikhwan. He had an ikhwan, not the ikhwan of Egypt. He had an ikhwan in Saudi Arabia. And the ikhwan had to be given some explanation for this money that we are taking from Britain. What did Abdulaziz say to them? That's right. He said, this money is jizya. Jizya, a punitive tax. Punitive means punishment. A punitive tax imposed by the Islamic State upon a subject non-Muslim people, Jews and Christians, whose territory has been conquered and who now wish to continue to reside in that territory. Jizya. This was a joke. The reason why we have that information about the treaty, the text of the treaty, and this provision in the treaty about £5,000 a month, is because a young, ambitious historian named Arnold Toynbee published it in the Royal Institute of International Affairs publication. It used to be published every year, 1920, 21, 22. Please take a look at the 1925, I think, edition, and you'll find it there. In consequence of the strategic relationship that existed between Britain and Ibn Saud, Britain now acted. It was not a part of the British scheme of things that a client state, which is what Sharif al-Hussein is, could take such an initiative without British permission. Before Sharif al-Hussein claimed the caliphate, he was supposed to get permission from the British government. He did not. They did not want the caliphate to survive. It was not just that the young Turks wanted to destroy the caliphate in Turkey. It was that the Western civilization did not want the caliphate to survive. And so what happened? Britain now gave the green light to Abdulaziz Ibn Saud. We are behind you, the superpower of the world. You get rid of Sharif al-Hussein for us. Ibn Saud immediately responded. He's given all the weapons that he needs. And it takes about 3 months and Sharif Hussein is defeated. Makkah falls. Just before Makkah falls, Sharif al-Hussein flees to Jeddah. The British have a ship waiting there for him and they take him to Malta. This was the end of that short-lived Arab caliphate, March to June 1924. All right. Well, now Abdulaziz Ibn Saud, you control Makkah. 1925, he takes Jeddah, and I believe 1926, Medina falls. He could not take Medina earlier because Fakhri Pasha, a Turkish general with the heart of a Muslim, was defending Medina as though he's defending the Messenger of Allah. And they could not defeat Fakhri Pasha. Eventually they did the usual, there's a name of Jafar Mir, was his name? Jafar Mir? Yes. Mir Jafar. They did a Mir Jafar on Fakhri Pasha. And as a consequence of a betrayal from within his own ranks, Medina fell in 1926. All right. Well, why does Abdulaziz Ibn Saud not claim the caliphate for himself? I think you should ask that question. Because after all, these are the people who want to come and teach Imran Islam. These are the people who say to Imran, we have the true Islam. And they're financing masajid all over the world, in North America in particular, and paying handsome salaries for imams to be appointed because we, the Saudis, we've got the true Islam, the original Islam. Well, Bhaisab, if you have the true Islam, why do you not claim the caliphate for yourself now? After all, you now control Mecca, you control Medina, you control the Haramain. And you have a treaty with the superpower of the world. Just after the abolition of the caliphate in Istanbul on the 3rd of March 1924, there was a very significant initiative on the part of the world of Islamic scholarship. That was Al-Azhar University. The ulama of Al-Azhar plus the ulama of Egypt issued a statement in which they denounced the abolition of the Ottoman Caliphate. And they argued that the Caliphate was an integral part of the religion from the Sunni perspective. They called for a gathering of all Muslims, a Mu'tamar al-Khilafa, to examine this problem now and to appoint a new Khalifa. This was Al-Azhar University. If the most important institution of Islamic world, learning in the world had responded like that, that you must have a Khalifa, and if you are Wahhabis and you claim to be the pure Muslims, you should have now declared the Caliphate to be now in Mecca. Now let me introduce you to the great Saudi Wahhabi betrayal. Even if they had designs on the Caliphate, they could not claim the Caliphate. Why? Because they are now chamchas of Britain. And they will have to get the permission of His Majesty's government. And His Majesty's government will not give that permission. If the Saudis had ever made the mistake of claiming the Caliphate, at any time from 1924 to 1998, they would have been dispatched so quickly they wouldn't know what hit them. They knew that. They were clever enough to understand that Britain and the Western world and the Zionist movement did not want the Caliphate to be restored. And therefore, if they were to claim the Caliphate, they would be making a fatal mistake. And so, the so-called pure Puritan Wahhabi Islam betrayed the Ummah, abandoned the Caliphate. Not only did they abandon the Caliphate, but more importantly, by holding on to the Hijaz, by holding on to the Haramain, by holding on to the Hajj, and remaining under the American and the British umbrella, their security is guaranteed. They ensured that no one else could claim the Caliphate. How can you have a Khalifa in Lahore who does not have control over the Hajj and does not have control over the Haramain and the Hijaz? Can't have it. And so, the success of the destruction of the Caliphate had these political implications. Number one, to make it possible for an effort to be made to incorporate the entire world of Islam into the one global, essentially godless and decadent society which would now emerge through Western efforts. Number two, to make it possible for the state of Israel to be created and to weaken the capacity of the world of Islam to respond to the threat from Israel. Now, the Caliphate is destroyed. No more Khalifa. Maulana Muhammad Ali Jauhar مولانا شوکت علی, مفتی کفایت اللہ, شعیب قریشی, all these deans of the past, سلیمان ندوی, had all given bay'ah to Abdul Majid. Yes. How are we going to live now without a caliphate? The first response. Turkey has abandoned Darul Islam. Turkey has embraced the European model of a secular state. Sovereignty now resided in the state and parliament. This is followed shortly thereafter by Iran. The British pick up an ordinary, call him a foot soldier, I don't think the Shah would be too pleased with that, an engineer for his foot soldier to become Shahin Shah, Reza Khan. Reza Khan, Chamcha of the British, now takes Iran, which has a constitution from 1906, I think, now takes Iran along the same road to that model of a society which Turkey had embraced, the Western model. After Istanbul had opted out of the Islamic model, Darul Islam, after Iran, Shia Iran, had also opted for the new Western model, it was only a matter of time before Abdulaziz ibn Saud would make his move. The last betrayal. I think it was 1933 when the state or the kingdom of Saudi Arabia came into being. Hijaz, a word you no longer hear, it's gone. Majd, a word you no longer hear, it's gone. The Saudis wanted it to be forgotten. There's a reason why they wanted the word Majd to be forgotten. Because once the Prophet said, "Allahumma barik lana fi shamina," may Allah bless us with our Sham, Syria. "Allahumma barik lana fi Yemenina," may Allah bless us with our Yemen. Today Yemen is the only one fighting riba. Fighting riba. So the people of Najd ask the Messenger of Allah, "What about Najd? Why not Allahumma barik lana fi Najdina?" He pointed to Najd and he said, "Karn shaitan," the horns of Satan. And so the Saudis wanted the word Najd to be dropped. So Hijaz also had to be dropped. And so the name of the new state is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It has opted for the Western model. Where is the evidence? Because the state of Saudi Arabia comes with all the trappings of the Western model. Does it not have territorial sovereignty? Oh yes. Does it not have Saudi citizenship? Oh yes. Yesterday, when we went to the Hijaz, yesterday, we were, like the Saudi Muslims. The only distinction between us and them is that we were Musafir and they were Sakin. That's all. No difference. But now, we are foreign nationals. And they're citizens. We need a visa to enter their country. And all the oil that Allah placed there no longer belongs to the world of Islam. It's theirs, and if they want to give it to Uncle Sam, that's their business. And so this is the Western model which has come to the heartland of Islam. By the time that 1947 arrived, Muhammad Ali Jinnah had no alternative. There was no way that the Muslim League could have taken any other course than the one it took. After Mustafa Kemal had acted in Turkey, Reza Khan had acted in Iran, and Abdulaziz ibn Saud had acted in Mecca. The classical model of political organization in Islam was gone, and Muhammad Ali Jinnah had the wisdom to realize it could not be resurrected. And so what had to come into being was the state of Pakistan. You could not bring Darul Islam into being in 1947. Within the frontiers of the modern national state, you are now going to try to see what kind of brush you can use to paint it Islamic. And so Pakistan was born in 1947 in basically the same model as Turkey, because it had territorial sovereignty, it had citizenship, it had on all the rest. Soon after its birth, however, because Pakistan was born on the basis of an Islamic movement, Pakistan ka matlab kya, la ilaha illallah, and the Muslims had struggled on the basis of love for Islam, soon after Pakistan was born, it launched a spiritual effort. When we look at it today, it looks so innocent and yet so naive. A spiritual effort was launched for building Islamic solidarity. There are names which can be called now out of the pages of history, forgotten names. This is 1948. But in 1952, something happens that puts a spanner in the works, and that is the Egyptian Revolution. Between 1952 and 1954, there's an interim period when General Naguib is in charge, but General Nasser is the man behind the scene calling the shots. 1954, Nasser considers it, Colonel Nasser, it is now time, I can push him aside and take over. The new Egyptian government became the most formidable force in the world of Islam, seeking to prevent Pakistan and like-minded people from establishing some kind of a solidarity of these newly emerging nation states which were peopled by Muslim people. It was not until 1969, August 1969, when a fire took place in Masjid al-Aqsa. That was the first attempt that the Jews made to destroy Masjid al-Aqsa, to rebuild the Temple of Solomon. The next attempt is coming soon, I believe. It was not until the fire in Masjid al-Aqsa, which had, among other things, destroyed a minbar, which had been built by Salahuddin Ayyubi. When that occasion took place, it galvanized the world of Islam. And the world of Islam then met in an Islamic summit conference in Rabat in Morocco in September 1969. The Western world could not prevent it. Israel could not prevent it. But India did its very best to try to prevent it. India, between August and September 1969, used every trick in the book to ensure that it gets an invitation. We have the Muslim, biggest Muslim community in the world. The Indian Muslim community has been so influential in history. remember him? Arrived in Rabat. When the opening session of the conference began, the Rabat Summit Conference, the Indians had very skillfully appointed as the leader of their delegation the Vice Chancellor of Aligarh Muslim University, a Muslim. But as Allah would have it, the Vice Chancellor could not reach the conference in time to participate in the opening session. The Indians very foolishly allowed a Sikh with a big turban to sit at the table of heads of state representing India. When Yahya Khan entered into the room and he saw the Indian delegate sitting there on the table, remember Yahya Khan knew that India had been invited. He knew it. But he couldn't take it. Either he was Pathan or Punjabi, one or the other. Yahya Khan turned around and walked out. He may have been Sharabi, but at that moment, he was a ferocious lion. He walked out. And that created a diplomatic storm. Because Yahya Khan went back to his villa and decided, I am not going to the conference. So long as India is there. Faisal of Arabia, diplomat as he was, did everything he could to try to persuade the Pakistan delegation to return to the conference table. He tried everything he could to get the Indians to be a bit conciliatory and to moderate their position. When he did not succeed, Faisal had the diplomatic wisdom to realize that he could not proceed without Pakistan. And so the conference met and decided to throw out India. Do you remember that? India was thrown out of the Rabat Summit Conference. The effort to try to thwart from within, because the United States couldn't sit there and Israel couldn't sit there. The effort to try to thwart and to destroy this incipient effort at the establishment of Islamic solidarity failed because India was thrown out. But the OIC which emerged was dominated by forces which were aligned to the West. Faisal hand-picked Abdurrahman, Tanku Abdurrahman Putra, to be the new, the first Secretary General. Tanku Abdurrahman was the replica of Malay nationalism with some attachment to Islam for purposes of political expediency. The West now ensured that the OIC did not emerge and could not emerge as anything more than a talk shop. But Faisal, may Allah bless him, persisted. Mistake after mistake, but he persisted. Because something happened to his soul in 1967 when Jerusalem was lost, when Masjid al-Aqsa was lost. Something happened. That Saudi soul inside of him changed. No longer this British and American underlaw over my head, not Faisal anymore. Now his heart longs, he utters the words, I want to perform Salat once more in Masjid al-Aqsa before I die. And so Faisal builds 1970, Jamal Abdel Nasser dies. Before this, Faisal is able to patch up with Nasser and end the war in Yemen. When Nasser is succeeded by Sadat, then Faisal builds a bridge with Sadat, and together they planned the war for 1973.